All right, so let's begin with today's sutta, which is the Madhu Pindika Sutta. It's the Majjhima number 18, and it is being offered by popular request, at least by two of the diehard sutta attendees. So this is a very profound sutta and a much longer sutta than we normally do. So I will read through the first half without opening up for too much discussion, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty in the second half, which is where a chief disciple of the Buddha elaborates the Buddha's statement in the first half. And you will see that this is all about perception. It's about the way the mind spins out and proliferates and creates whole universes for itself. I was speaking to a bhikkhuni friend today, and they're involved in this virtual reality kind of Dharma teaching thing. And I was thinking, wow, that's yet another universe, isn't it, that we create, a virtual one. And in a way, all of our universes are kind of fabrications of our mind, of our imagination. The more that we, proliferate and spin stories, the less real, in a sense, the world we live in, or the more created it becomes. So the Buddha is talking in here about how to notice the whole process, the whole perceptual apparatus, and the way that occurs, and to end our infatuation with it and come to the end of craving. So let's begin. So usually these sort of start with the phrase, "Thus have I heard," and this is the voice of Venerable Ananda, who had a very almost photographic memory. In the days of the Buddha, people would learn the suttas by heart through the oral tradition. So they would recite them again and again and remember them, because they didn't have written text at that time. So he's repeating what he heard directly from the Buddha's from this situation, from the Buddha and also the Venerable Mahakachayana, I think it is, Kachana, who was praised and esteemed by the Buddha. So, on one occasion, the Blessed One, which is the Buddha, was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavatthu in Nigrodha's park. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kapilavatthu for alms. When he'd wandered for alms in Kapilavatthu and had returned from his alms round, after his meal he went to the great wood for the day's abiding, and entering the great wood, sat down at the root of a bilva sapling for the day's abiding. So this is already very evocative of the life of monastics in the Buddha's day, and even to some extent to this day. Whether or not we take our bowl and robe and wander for alms, we tend to take our bowl and robe at least into the dharamsala and receive the alms food from the lay supporters. And the purpose, one of the purposes of eating the meal before noon or before solar noon, in other words, in the first half of the day, is that after the meal, we can seek solitude. We retire to solitude, to a conducive place to practice meditation and to find some stillness. So here he entered the great wood and sat down at the root of a bilva sapling for the day's abiding. I can't remember that tree exactly, but we studied that in Ayurveda. I'm not sure if it's Bibitaki, but anyway, it's a tree which I think has medicinal properties. Okay, Dandapani, the Sakyan, while walking and wandering for exercise, also went to the great wood. And when he'd entered the great wood, he went to the bilva sapling where the Blessed One was and exchanged greetings with him. So that was the end of the Buddha's solitude. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side, leaning on his stick, and asked the Blessed One, "What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim?" And in the footnotes here, it says that that was quite an arrogant and entitled way to approach the Buddha. And it was meant to deliberately provoke the Buddha, in a sense, to engage him in an argument. And that this stick that he was walking with was basically for vanity. It was like a gold-gilted stick or gold-plated stick that he didn't really need because he wasn't very old. So he's setting this up for an argument. It's getting hot. So the Buddha replies, "Friend, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas. In this generation, with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people. In such a way that perceptions no more underlie that Brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being." In other words, any kind of state of existence. So here he is responding as to how not to quarrel and saying that the world may quarrel with him, but he doesn't quarrel with the world. That's another famous quote of the Buddha. So, and this is because he's not giving so much value to perceptions. And here when he says that no more underlie that Brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures, he means Brahmin in the sense of someone who's purified their mind. So in this case, he means himself, the Buddha. So he's saying that he's free from those perceptions that would give rise to sensual pleasures. He abides free from perplexity and worry, free from craving for any kind of existence. When this was said, Dandapani the Shakyan shook his head, wagged his tongue, and raised his eyebrows until his forehead were puckered in three lines. Can you do that, three lines? I think I get one big line. Then he departed, leaning on his stick. He swaggered off with his stick. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One arose from meditation and went to Nigrodha's park, where he sat down on a seat made ready for him and told the bhikkhus, the monks or the monastic community, maybe lay people too, what had taken place. Then a certain monastic asked the Blessed One, "But Venerable Sir, how does the Blessed One assert and proclaim his teaching in such a way that he does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its Maras, its Brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people? And how, Venerable Sir, is that how is it that perceptions no more underlie the Blessed One, that Brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being?" Do we want to know this? Would you like to be free from any kind of worry and detached from sensual pleasures, free from any kind of craving? Does that sound appealing? You don't have to say yes. Sometimes we say yes, but actually we don't really want to be free from craving. We still enjoy craving, right? We're still addicted to that. But still, that sounds pretty cool. So then the Blessed One answers, "Monastics, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, or in other words, existence, of the underlying tendency to delusion." I'm going to translate ignorance here as delusion. "This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here, these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder." Phew. This is very timely to hear, isn't it? Because there's so much of this happening in the world, on social media, in the news, in real life. Probably on virtual reality, I don't know. Maybe virtual reality is more peaceful. I hope so. I hope nobody would actually intentionally create a virtual reality that was so fraught with conflict, but then that's what we're doing in the world. It's crazy. So when there's no more desire, in other words, coming from a sense of self, then this is the end of resorting to quarrels. And these things cease without remainder. So I just had a little look in the footnotes, and this idea of perceptions and notions born of proliferation is a translation of a term, papancha sanya sankar. So papancha literally means kind of proliferation. So it's really the way we imagine and build on bare information that we receive at any one of the senses. It goes beyond the bare experience and into the realm of thoughts, concepts, ideas, and then all the kind of procrastination around that. You know, I like the word papancha because it sounds kind of like what we do, papancha, pancha, pancha, just chattering on and on and on. And then perception. Notions arisen from proliferation, a proliferation of perception, I think it is. So it means kind of what we create from that, the notions that we create from seeing things and then basically making much of them, making more of them, twisting and bending them to suit often what we want to believe, what we want to see, yeah, not how things really are. And of course, often we think that our perception is really true. The way we perceive it is the way it is, right? We really buy into that. And this is where quarrels happen. I mean, just recently, you must have heard of the absolutely horrendous news of, what was her name? Renee Nicole Good in America. And the quarrels and brawls and disputes around the same video footage. If you want to believe that, you know, she deserved to be shot, then you'll read it one way and you'll see that ICE officer as simply doing their job, you know, under threat or actually endangered in some way by her peaceful protest. Other people watch the same footage and say clearly there was no threat. The wheels were turned to the right and nowhere near that officer. She was actually trying to get away. It was a moment of confusion. She was there as an ally, as a, you know, a protective force to the horrible totalitarian behaviour of these, yeah, I don't know what you call them. They're not lawful people. So this is an example of perception, creating a completely different story and then ending up in brawls and disputes and even more cruelty, even more conflict in this world. So this is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. So that's his teaching in brief. Then, soon after the Blessed One has gone, the monastics considered, "Now, friends, the Blessed One has risen from his seat and gone into his dwelling, after giving a summary in brief, without expounding the detailed meaning. Now, who will expound this in detail?" Then they considered, "The Venerable Mahakachana was praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. He's capable of expounding the detailed meaning. Suppose we went to him and asked him the meaning of this." Then the monastics went to the Venerable Mahakachana and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down to one side and told him what had taken place, adding, "Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it to us." So you're not the only ones confused and wanting a bit more explanation here. The Venerable Mahakachana replied, "Friends, it is as though a person needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, thought that heartwood should be sought for among the branches and leaves of a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, after he'd passed over the root and the trunk. And so it is with you, Venerable Sirs, that you think I should be asked about the meaning of this after you pass the Blessed One by while you are face to face with the teacher. For knowing, the Blessed One knows. Seeing, he sees. He is vision. He is knowledge. He is the Dhamma. He is the Holy One, the slayer, proclaimer, elucidator of meaning, the giver of, I'm going to translate deathless as no more dying. Isn't that radical? It's not a state. The Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. The Tathagata means one who is thus gone. In other words, the Buddha. It's just an epithet for the Buddha. That was the time when you should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told you, so you should have remembered it. And here he's being very humble because the Venerable Mahakachana, as we've said, is highly qualified to be able to elucidate the meaning. And he himself was fully enlightened too. So his wisdom was perfected. He had the wisdom of an arahat. And yet still, the Blessed One, the Buddha, had this gift of speaking the Dhamma in a way that was perfect. So then the monks and nuns say to him, surely, friend Kachana, knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees, he is vision, etc., etc. He is knowledge, he is the Dhamma, he is the Holy One, the slayer, proclaimer, elucidator of meaning, Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time when we should have asked the Blessed One on the meaning. As he told us, so we should have remembered it. And yet the Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. The Venerable Mahakachana is capable of expounding the detailed meaning of this summary given in brief by the Blessed One without expounding the detailed meaning. Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it without finding it troublesome. Then listen, friends, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friends, the monastics replied, and the Venerable Mahakachana said this. So now we get into the heart of the sutta, and I just want to point out how beautiful this whole sutta is up until now, to just give an example of living in harmony, you know, of humility, of respect, and of, in a sense, harmonizing with what is being said, and then going ahead and anyway asking for him to proclaim the Dhamma. So they didn't just say, no, we did the right thing. We wanted to ask you, not the Buddha. They kind of agreed very beautifully in a way that showed that appreciation to their teacher, to the Buddha especially. So this is what the Venerable Mahakachana now expounds. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling, after giving a summary in brief without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, bhikkhus, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, the underlying tendency to views, to doubt, to conceit, to desire for being, to delusion, and the end of resorting to rods and weapons, quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words and false speech. Here, these unwholesome, evil states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of it to be as follows. So how does this whole process work? I can see there are some messages in the chat, so I'm just going to come to those to make sure things are clear till now. Yeah, the name of the sutta, that's been added. Who wrote the suttas? How has it been preserved for many centuries? So the suttas were first written down on palm leaves in Sri Lanka, and I forget the exact date, but it When do you know the exact date-ish? I mean, we don't know the exact date, obviously. The first time they were redacted, which means recited and kind of gone through, was shortly after the Buddha's passing by a group of 500 fully enlightened people, which just means a big amount of monastics. And then there was another Sangha council, they call them, I think about 200 years later, wasn't it, in the time of Asoka?
I think so.
Yeah. And so this would happen again and again, and at some point there, they were written down on palm leaves in Sinhala in Sri Lanka. And the councils have continued. The last one was in the 50s, I think. And my first teacher, Esen Goenka, was actually attending that, and along with many other very famous Burmese monks and reputed teachers of that day. Excellent. Somebody's gone into the website to find out the exact. Okay. First committed to palm leaves around the first century BCE, about 400 to 500 years after the Buddha's death. And then somebody else says 30 BC in Sri Lanka. So I don't know. Yeah, there's a big difference there, right? So we can't know exactly, but Imatale Alu Wihare in Sri Lanka. Excellent. 30 BC? I wonder what actual date that is. I can't really get that in my head. Anyway, so these are very authentic. There's a lovely book called The Authenticity of the Buddhist Texts by Ajahn Pramali and Banta Sajjato, which was published in Oxford, actually, I think, by the Buddhist Mindfulness something. I forget exactly the organisation. But if you look it up online, you can download it for free, and it's very accessible and reader-friendly. And it talks about how we can authenticate these suttas to show that basically the most plausible explanation is that they were written by the same person, they were spoken by the same person, and a very, very special person that can be placed in time and in history. And that person is basically the historical Buddha. So there's a very, very high correlation. And also, these suttas were preserved in Pali, but also in was it Sanskrit in China? I'm not quite sure. Or was it Chinese? But they were preserved in China also in parallel texts, and they're almost identical. And these have been preserved in completely different continents, right? Or different parts of the Asian continent. And yet they are incredibly similar. And any place that you might feel like, oh, that sounds strange, that doesn't sound quite like what the Buddha might say, or it's misogynistic, or it's kind of disagrees with something in another sutta, you can usually check it out against the parallel suttas in the Chinese canons. So I think Majjhima Nikaya has the parallel of the Madhyamika, something like that. And you'll usually find that that paragraph or that sutta even is missing from one or the other, whereas the rest are almost identical. So it's very interesting, and there's all kinds of it's a very interesting book, actually, if anyone wants to read that. Yeah. So here we go. Are there any questions on the meaning so far of this, or shall we just kind of dive right in with the more detail? Okay, here we go. So this is what the Mahakachana understood. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three, that's eyes, forms, and eye consciousness, is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. And with what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person with respect to the past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Do you recognize that process happening within you? Does that make sense? So dependent, and this is in a way a summation of dependent imagination, only going through the senses one by one. So dependent on the eye and forms, you have to have an eye and you have to have forms in order for eye consciousness to arise. And when those three things come together, that's called contact. It's that meeting of these three things that conditions feeling. So only from there we can know if it's pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. There's an affective tone to experience at the eye sense door. You like it or you don't like it. It's pleasant. It's boring. Boring's not really a feeling, but it's a kind of perception that arises. So whatever we feel, immediately we perceive what we feel. The two things kind of arise together. Although this is slightly sequential because one thing depends on the next, they're also inseparable, because as soon as there's a feeling, we're aware of that feeling. We perceive it. We can say this is pleasant, this is unpleasant. That's a perception. And then what one perceives, one thinks about. So in a way, this is talking about the first few khandhas. So the five khandhas are like form, materiality, and then feeling and perception, and then will or mental volition, if you like. So here we have iron forms, that's the materiality. Eye consciousness is already there, and the contact, and then that contact conditions feeling, the second of the khandhas, of the aspects of existence. And what one feels, one perceives, that's the third khandha or component of existence. And what one perceives, one thinks about. So it's that moving from bare feeling and perception to starting to think, that's the active part of the mind. And that is very similar to sankhara, to the volition or the reactivity of the mind. So what one thinks about, one mentally proliferates. We can go on and on and on about that and work ourselves up into a real hot mess. Or think about it in a way that actually reduces the defilements in the mind, right? But it's basically that thinking that's adding a lot to the bare experience of the sensory apparatus. So we mentally proliferate that. And with that proliferation, perceptions and notions born of proliferation arise. So that's additional perceptions, right? This person shouldn't have done that. That was really wrong. And then you start perceiving them as a terrible person or as something to be afraid of. And then notions, it becomes more and more solid, more and more kind of consolidated in the mind. And we try to make things very fixed. And then we get these notions with respect to the past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. So we might remember things in the past that remind us of the same. We might start to project into the future that same notion that you have, say, about a person is going to come up again later. You're going to see them again, or they're going to be even more angry and obnoxious next time. And present forms as well, cognizable through the eye. And then this goes for all of the senses. So we have eye, ear, nose, taste, touch, and also mind consciousness. So dependent on the ear and sounds, sound consciousness arises, or ear consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there's feeling. What one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person with respect to the past, future, and present sounds cognizable through the ear. The same with dependent on the nose, odours arise. Dependent on the tongue, flavour and flavours. Sorry, dependent on the nose and odours, nose consciousness arises. Dependent on the tongue and flavors, tongue consciousness arises, etc. Dependent on the body intangibles, body consciousness arises. And the last one I'll read in full again. Dependent on the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. If anybody tries to tell you in the Dhamma, in Buddhism, that mind consciousness is who you are, or mind consciousness is somehow the unconditioned itself, refer them to this or any other part of the Nidana Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. Here it is saying dependent on the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. So it's dependent, it's dependently arisen. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. So if there's no contact also, there's no feeling at the mind door, there's no experience, in other words. Ajahn Brahm actually translates feeling these days as experience. We can only experience what we actually feel, right? So feeling is direct experience. Anything else is conceptual, really. It doesn't really exist for us, right, until we feel it and then perceive that we feel it. So what one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. And a lot of this thought is about, actually mostly about the five senses. It's mostly about the five senses, isn't it? A lot of our thinking is about sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches that we've had in the past or that we want to be having now or wish we weren't having now or that we'd like to have in the future. So what one perceives, one thinks about, what one thinks about, one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person with respect to past, future and present mind objects cognizable through the mind. So any questions or comments so far, or any experience that you may have had in your life that is a good example of this process happening? It'd be really interesting to hear from you about this, just to make sure it's landing somehow, yeah, or clarify any confusion. Hi, Georgia.
Hiya, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, great.
Yeah, cool. Thank you for that. Yeah, I think on a personal level with this, I found it really useful with things like illness.
Yeah.
And the sensations of pain. I'm not feeling well. Where I struggle with it is in more of a global sense. Just in the sense that I think there are a lot of people who have to kind of quarrel with the world to get their basic needs met.
Absolutely.
So how do we navigate these kind of systems of oppression that we're all living in without, in a wise way,
yeah,
like, with these teachings in mind, but without like increasing harm, if that makes sense of the question?
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for that. It's so important. And I think it's great that more and more people are thinking about the global situation that we're in. We can't really shut that out. It's impossible. I mean, we're global citizens with a responsibility, you know, to our fellow human beings and animals as well. And I think the trick really is not in not having disagreements. It's really about where we're coming from. It's about those underlying tendencies that we talked about in the beginning. You know, that the thing that creates these quarrels is the underlying tendencies. First of all, delighting in, welcoming and holding on to certain types of perceptions, certain types of proliferation, certain types of feelings, right? We hold on to them. In other words, there's craving. We don't want things to be that way. We want things to be a different way, which is understandable. But if that is leading to, you know, delighting in some things, welcoming to them, holding on to them, it doesn't say pushing them away or not delighting in them, but in a way it's the same thing. We sometimes delight and hold on to anger too, or to thoughts of injustice or thoughts that actually feel true and maybe are true, but it can move into kind of a sense of moral indignation that's not allowing our minds to stay calm enough to see clearly what needs to be done. So when we're clinging to these things, that creates this tendency to lust, and then also to aversion, and then to views. And views is already where we start to think, isn't it? This person shouldn't have done that. I think it should be this way, not that way. Of the underlying tendency to doubt, to conceit, to desire for being, tendency to delusion. And this leads to the rods and weapons, the quarrels, brawls, disputes, etc., etc. So I think this is actually pointing us to just staying with our experience and not allowing the mind to start being driven by greed, hate and delusion, but remaining kind of clear in ourselves and then able to act from a place that is more objective, if you like. I don't think there's ever any, you know, suttas in the teachings where the Buddha's saying, you know, just accept things the way they are. Actually, he doesn't really talk that way. He approaches people quite firmly sometimes and says things like, "You stupid person, you foolish person, you know, how could you think that the Buddha teaches this way when actually he's teaching another way?" So I think the Buddha's all about overcoming the suffering in ourselves and the way that we view things that creates extra suffering and leads us to act from a place of greed and aversion rather than a place of, what could we say? You could call it fierce compassion, but ethical compassion. You know, so often the Brahmaviharas are sort of overlooked as sources of energy that lead to action. And we think we have to feel angry or we have to feel, you know, the pain of the world to such an extent that we're kind of feeling it with the others. And sometimes we allow ourselves to get overwhelmed, but that's not really the purpose of empathy. The purpose of empathy to me is to understand that people are suffering and to genuinely feel that you want to help them, but then to transform that empathy into compassion, into an actual ability to do something to alleviate their suffering. And I think as long as we're just mentally proliferating, we're not actually acting. We're just wearing ourselves out. Does that make sense? I mean, it's a big question that deserves a whole Dhamma talk, really. But, yeah. Thanks. Okay, there's a couple of comments in... Oh, three, actually. Okay, I'll go to one comment in the chat first and then come to Diana. So I don't want to leave out the people in the chat. What does mind consciousness mean? So it just means whatever we're... It just means the capacity to be aware of things mentally, I think. Mind consciousness is... being aware of what you know. So in a sense, mind consciousness can be aware of what you ate, right? Or of what you smelt, but only afterwards. So one of the difficulties with understanding the impermanence of mind consciousness is that it seems to be there all the time because you taste something and then you know that you've tasted it and you think that you're aware while you're tasting it. But in fact, this process is happening so quickly that you taste something, then you know, then the mind knows that it tasted something. Then you smell something and the mind knows that you smelt something. So it's the knowing part of consciousness, but it's different from the other five senses. So you have, that's why these six are described separately. So Ajahn Brahm has this thing called the fruit salad simile. And it's like you have, say, the nose is a banana, the ear is an apple. I don't know what the tongue is. It could be a mango or something. And then the mind is a coconut. And so you have this mango, then you have a coconut, then you have a banana, then a coconut. And then you might have like two apples and then a coconut, something like this. So the consciousnesses are all coming and going at different times. They're not actually joined up, so to speak, but because the mind consciousness has some kind of similarity to it, because it knows what's happening, we sometimes think it's always there and it's kind of in the background, just waiting to receive input from the other senses. In fact, they're all coming and going all the time. But that would take very deep meditation and the ability to see things at such an incredible speed to be able to pick that up. So sometimes the simile is given of like grains of sand on the beach, that from a distance it looks like just one sheet. It looks like something that's, you know, doesn't have any gaps. But when you get closer, you see that it's actually all separate grains. So it's the knowing part of the mind, that which knows. But there's no that. It's knowing itself, knowing. I hope that makes some sense. I mean, these things are difficult to understand unless we can actually separate mind consciousness from the other five senses. And that's why in our tradition, I suppose through Ajahn Brahm's teachings in particular, he emphasizes practicing jhana, because that's a time that the five senses recede so much into the background that the mind is incredibly strong. And to the point that the five senses actually vanish for some time in those deep meditations. And after that, when you come back into the world of the five senses, you can more easily differentiate the quality of the mind from the other five senses. Does that make sense? Yeah. Diana, can I come to you?
Hi, Venerable Chanda. Thank you. Thanks for calling on me. I'm just thinking about the previous question about how we can have these difficult conversations with people when we don't agree. And maybe, we don't need to have those conversations if we're just going to be arguing, because the point of a conversation is to be productive. So if the goal is, let's see how each other thinks about this and see if we can find some common ground versus just, I think this, you know, it's kind of creating divisiveness, which is antithetical to right speech. And if it's someone you are involved with, like a family member or a friend, a relationship apart from this issue, I don't know if it makes sense to make that issue be the central focus or even make the whole relationship dependent on that. I don't know.
I think you've got a good point. And in a way, the Buddha gives this guidance, right, for right speech and speech that the first one actually is speech that is beneficial, right? Mm. So it can be true, but not beneficial. And then he says, better not to speak it. Mm. You can, but do it very carefully. So speech that is true and beneficial and spoken from a mind of loving kindness and gentle and timely is the best.
Yeah, timely.
And timely is really important. And sometimes timely might mean putting it, like you say, not in the front and center, but just maybe putting a small amount of feedback among a lot of, you know, conversation that actually builds people up. Like, for example, in this, when, it's a small, it wasn't about conflict, but I still like it, the way that in this sutta, the Venerable Mahakachayana says, why didn't you ask the Blessed One, basically, when he was here? Why did you come to me? It's like going to the twigs and the leaves when you've got the heartwood. And they didn't say, oh, well, that's because, they just said, yes, we went, why didn't we go to the Buddha why didn't we come to you when we could have gone to the Buddha? And they repeat the whole thing. And then they say, but we came to you because, you know, of your capacity to expand the Dhamma. So that's a way of actually agreeing, first of all, right? So finding that common ground and then putting things in a way that makes a person feel valued. So I think you're right. And I think with the situation in the world at the moment, it's difficult to get into conversations with people who've already landed on a very particular view. And especially if that view is going to, you know, sometimes when you challenge a person's view, they hold on to it even more tightly. They feel even more defensive. So I actually think one of the best things we can do is just act.
Right.
Go right beyond the speech. Don't even try to convince other people, but do what's right. Just do the right thing as you see it and put your energy into places that can kind of give another message or can support people who are, you know, being attacked or being marginalized and basically being persecuted. Try to actively do something there rather than kind of contend with people who are doing that. Lead by example, in other words. I think it's a bit of both. I mean, but we have to be very careful. Yeah. So I'll come to another comment from the chat. On a more lighthearted note, over Christmas, my little niece and nephew were singing songs from K-pop Demon Hunters, whoever they are, and I really delighted in their singing and then decided to watch the movie. Now I've noticed the songs keep ringing in my head without me even thinking about it. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Because you were delighting it. And that was all very nice at the time, but you might not want it coming up in your meditation. Yeah, quite a harmless thing. But at the same time, it shows just how impressionable these minds are, right? And how much care we have to take about what data we receive, about the data we receive and the effect it has on our minds. It's don't ever think you're beyond being conditioned and brainwashed, you know. If you're only getting one particular kind of feed on social media and all the people around you in your town, in your family, have the same view, then you can very quickly see things the same. Especially if, say, you know, it's been shown that people who tend to vote for more totalitarian regimes tend to be more fear-based psychologically. So if you grow up around an atmosphere of fear and, you know, you've learned to kind of be very wary of people who don't look like you, and you've been reading all the news on that, then you're likely to have those reactions when you see people, and those reactions are real. That's your actual genuine experience, is one of fear. So we are, this is why the Buddha says, why is friendship? Be careful about the input you receive. Nancy, can I come to you?
Hi. I had a question just in terms of the mind consciousness, right? Very helpful what you were saying about, you know, if you have the jhanas to try to at least have the senses somewhat resting, and then you can see the knowing in some way. But is, I guess, uncertainty for me is that is there, so you have the knowing. I don't know whether you want to call that the observing, the ability to reflect, whatever, the knowing, like, you know, part of the mind.
Yeah.
And is that happening kind of simultaneously with, like, I guess sometimes the way I read it, I might understand it as, well, you have the awareness of the consciousness or of the sense, experience, feeling, or the contact, but then simultaneously, is there this consciousness that's knowing that? And
great question.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to make it all sticky up, you know, but the idea of having a variety of capacities of consciousness.
Yeah, I think this is where it's about the speed of these things happening. I mean, I know this is Abhidhamma, but it was to some extent my experience in Myanmar when I was practicing with noticing the arising and passing away of phenomena in general, that you would manage to catch up with some speed, which was still very slow compared to how fast actually mind consciousness arises and passes. But you could see it would come and go many times in a second, like many, many times. And, you know, they say it's like trillions. The mind is fast. The mind is, you know, changing all the time. Is it in the, I think it's in one of the suttas in the Majjhima, I forget which one, but the Buddha said if you were to identify with anything, the mind or the body, then better identify with the body, because the body at least stays for some time. The mind is passing all the time. He doesn't say like the speed of light, but that's kind of what it means. So I think the trick here is that it seems that we know that we know. And that is the thing that can lead to the view that the mind is always there, that, you know, there's this thing behind the knowing almost, right? That's knowing the mind consciousness, like that there's mind consciousness, but there's this other knowing. But actually the way Ajahn Brahm describes it, because he's seen these things, I can't say that I've seen this yet, but he said it's that you know that you knew that you knew that you knew. Sure. And that makes all the difference, right? That makes the total difference. It's because these mind moments are separate and they're like sequential, but they're so fast that it really does seem like everything's happening at once. I mean, it seems to me like I'm looking at you and hearing my voice at the same time, but actually there's a millimoment of hearing, a millimoment of seeing, and then just vroom, 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 and in between that there's the mind knowing that that's happened.
Yes.
And it's like those cars, you know, those things that they used to have to make like cartoons. They used to have to draw many, many frames, and then they'd get flicked through really, really fast, and it looks like a continuous, unbroken sequence. I think it's like that.
It's not like you separate it out. And then the idea that you said that about consciousness, mind consciousness is not unconditioned.
Right. It's absolutely conditioned.
There are people I know that do say that there is the unconditioned, unformed, unborn component of, which I think is, however that understanding is for people that believe that there is some kind of, that's nibbana or that's something else that's like, but put that with consciousness is, anyway, be that as
it is. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's normal, isn't it, that our understanding of these things refines over time and through our practice. But I think, you know, we have to be very careful at landing on a particular view until we've really seen through this, because if the Buddha's actually saying that it is conditioned, which is very obvious here, right, about how these things are conditioned, then we need to keep boring in. We need to keep kind of going, because we can get to a certain point and, it looks as though there's this mind consciousness that's just so still and so immovable. I mean, that's where Ajahn Brahm says it's good to go through more deep jhanas. We're talking about jhanas that he would define as jhanas, states that he would define as jhanas, where there's no five sense input at all. So, and then you have this, what he sometimes calls pure mind consciousness, but not in a sense that it's permanent, but just mind consciousness without the impingement of the other senses. And then that will change through the jhanas. The quality of that mind consciousness will change through the jhanas. So in other words, part of mind consciousness starts to disappear. So the first one, PT, then the second one, there's the PT starts. I think the PT is gone in the third, isn't it? I forget now. But anyway, they change, and then it becomes so incredibly refined. It's like neither perception nor non-perception, right, in the arupa state. So there's barely anything to perceive anymore. There's actually no object, but there's still a tiny bit of perception. That's what you perceive. And so eventually,
a little bit.
And then eventually the feeling and perception both cease. And that is synonymous to nirodha, to cessation, to basically an experience of nibbana in the here and now, in this present life. So, yeah, it's understandable that different philosophies arise at various points on the path. And it's just us, as long as we see that it's a work in progress, our view is a work in progress, in a sense. I think it's okay. But for me, when I read about...
to those views and opinions, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just keep exploring. But also take the Buddha's words seriously, because the Buddha is saying it again and again, that it's all conditioned. He never, ever said, hey, I'm enlightened now, and my first most important revelation is that mind is who you are, the knowing, you are the knowing. He did not say that. You know, if that was his main insight, that was what he would have been teaching all the time. And that's not what he was saying. He was saying that.
And actually, it's far more, you know, you just have to keep with it to understand it. It's like that would be almost easy on some level.
Right, exactly. Almost easy. But to me, very unsatisfactory, because I want an end of all suffering. And to me, it's like if there would still be something there, that for me wouldn't do it. It just feels right. This just feels right. It just feels, I don't know, to me it's not scary. I mean, it might be scary when I'm getting closer, right? But I'm sure that fear can come up. But the thought of complete freedom, that all this is conditioned and subject to cessation, which is what he's saying in the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the second teaching that gave rise to the first five other arahats. Just went through every single kanda, including the mind, to say all mind consciousness, far or near, superior or inferior, gross or subtle, all mind consciousness is not me, not mine, not self. Subject to suffering, subject to impermanence, subject to
change. Chanting that in the morning is so, I do it in English because I'm not Pali person. But I do it. It's so, so helpful at the point of time in the morning. The third time, it's repeated and repeated every day.
Brilliant.
Really, really helps.
That's what we're talking about. Good conditioning. Good input for the senses. Yeah, wonderful. Great.
Thank you.
Primes your mind. Well, not your mind.
The mind.
Okay. Venerable Ajahn, regarding experience or the feeling kanda, does it mean actual physical feeling, i.e. physical feeling, or is it more to which Ajahn Brahms calls experience? Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons he calls it experience, is because it's not just physical feeling. Since you have experience with the Goenka method, is this a good method to understanding the feeling kanda? And is it complementary to Anapanasati? Wow, this is a big question. I love this Dhamma stuff. That's why it's getting good questions. Is this a good method to understanding the feeling kanda? And is it complementary to Anapanasati practice taught by Ajahn Brahm in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond? A lot of questions there, and there's some yeses and some noes. And also, whatever I'm saying, it's not like the definitive answer, right? This is just how I see it and how I'm phrasing it now through my experience, which is obviously limited. Feeling means feeling of any of the six senses, including the mind. So feeling is the pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between feeling of the body, which is physical feelings or sensations of the eye, the nose, the tongue, taste, and the mind. So Vedana can be pleasant or unpleasant in any of those areas. So I quite like the word experience. Veda, the Vedas, I think meant knowledge. You know, the Vedas in Hinduism meant knowledge. So in other words, what you know, what you experience. So it's something that you know, but to know something, it has to make contact, doesn't it? So it has to be experienced. And the Buddha's teaching is always about direct experience. So with the Goenka method, is it a good method to understand the feeling kanda? Definitely, I would say, even though you're making the physical feeling the foundation, the main focus, it's the easiest way in, for me anyway, because to sit there and just feel the impressions from the nose and the feelings of that, that would be almost like smell, right? Smell's not always there, for one thing. And secondly, you might not really know how it's affecting you at a deeper level. But by being with your physical feelings, you can even start to experience how sights and sounds and smells affect those feelings in your body. And you realize you're not really reacting to the objects outside. You're reacting to the way they make you feel. So you stay with that feeling. You know, like if you meet a person, it's not really that you don't like the look of them. It's more that when you see their face, for example, or say when you see a beautiful person, you think, oh, that's a beautiful person. It's because you see their face and the impression of their face causes a pleasant feeling that you can feel in your body. And that's much more tangible and easy to get in touch with than this kind of abstract idea of their face. That's more like conceptual. Does that make sense? There's actually a flow of physical feelings that goes along with all the sensory input. So it's quite helpful to work with the body. And then, of course, you start experiencing, I mean, the feeling kanda is a mental kanda. So the feeling itself is something that happens in the mind. I'm not explaining it very well because I'm quite tired. But basically, it's a gateway to understanding feeling in all the senses, including the mind. And whether it's complementary to Anapanasati depends on your approach to Anapana, I think. Because for me, I was so steeped in feeling and feeling sensations in particular that even with Anapana, I would feel the feelings and not quite be able to let go of that. And there's a point in Anapana, as taught by Ajahn Brahm in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, as the question goes, where you need to let go of that feeling, physical feeling, and just experience the breath through the mind sense door, so the pleasure of the breath, and it becomes actually more conceptual. It's a strange thing, but it needs an object that's much more solid to get into deep samadhi. If everything's just dissolving all the time, that's a very difficult place to go into deep jhana. So observing the sensations of the breath tends to take you more on a wisdom insight path, where everything's dissolving and you're seeing the impermanence, allowing the breath to become very stable, very kind of peaceful, and getting more and more in touch with like a steady feeling that stays the same is more slightly more fabricated, but it's a more stable object to go into samadhi states. So it's about the way you observe the breath. So for me, I had to actually come out of experiencing the breath too much through the physical sense door. But still, I wouldn't say that's the case for everyone. That's because I was doing a lot of Vipassana, like full time, like 18 hours a day, and also even sometimes through the night. So otherwise, I think all these methods kind of complement each other. You have to find out for yourself, because everybody's mind's different. Okay, so your mind automatically goes to the mental breath. Okay, good. So that means you're kind of more resonating or inclined at the moment in your practice to the process that Ajahn Brahm's describing. That makes sense to you. That's happening naturally. So, yeah. In the experience of an enlightened person, do these whole chains still happen, or are they disrupted or let go of without leading to proliferation described in this sutta? Yes, very good question. We're not finishing the sutta, are we? We might have to finish it next week. Yes, I had thought about that earlier. So for an enlightened person, dependent on I and forms, I consciousness still arises. The meeting of the three is contact that's happening. With contact as condition, there is feeling. Yes, that still happens. What one feels, that one perceives, that still happens. What one perceives, one thinks about. That may happen depending on the person, depending on whether they want to think about it or not. So they have some ability to stay quiet if they wish, or to actively think, actively use thought. And I know that Ajahn Brahm sometimes decides not to think on his walking path. And if he wants to think, he moves his hands from in front of him, which is the posture he uses when he's not thinking, and he moves his hands behind him. And then he very consciously and deliberately thinks about whatever he needs to think about. And it does say, actually, in either the Dvaita Vitakka or the Vitakka Santana Sutta, it might be the Vitakka Santana, I think, Majjhima number 20, it says that once we have some ability to work with thought and to kind of displace unwholesome thought with wholesome thought and then to quieten thought altogether, we're able to think whatever we want to think and not think whatever we don't want to think. Imagine that. So you can just think wholesome thoughts. You could just think useful thoughts, or you could just think the amount of thoughts you need to plan something or to organise something, but not more than that. So I think that that wouldn't necessarily go to proliferation. It might not go to proliferation, unless you wanted it to, perhaps. But proliferation tends to mean you're chewing over something unnecessarily, wasting a lot of energy, and it's not very helpful anymore. What one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions beset a person. So yeah, I think it's the proliferation place that would stop. And there's a sutta in here, I think it's towards the end, is it? It might be the very last one. That's the Indriya Bhavana Sutta. It might be another one. It's one where the Buddha's teaching, one of the great disciples who becomes a great disciple, and I forget which one, and this disciple is already fairly enlightened but hasn't gone the full way, and he's wondering what is missing, and the Buddha basically said, it's proliferation, you're still proliferating. I'll get back to you on that if I remember which sutta it is, because that's a lovely one. Okay. So, yeah, okay, mind consciousness, I think we've looked at. What is the morning condition chant? Condition chant, I love that. The condition chant is to free you from the conditioning of the view of a self. It's called the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, and it's a very deep sutta, and I don't remember the exact place in the suttas where that is. Is it Samyutta 22.45, or is that the Dhammacakka? That might be the Anatta Lakkhana. It's in the Samyutta chapter 22, which is the Khanda Samyutta. It's basically the teaching on non-self. You can look it up as the teaching on non-self. Yeah. What is the difference in the mental breath and the physical sensation of breath when you're experiencing it? So the physical sensation tends to be focused on just that, physical sensation. There's a physicality, there's a kind of, you can feel the impermanence sometimes, you can feel the heat, the coldness, etc. Mental breath is exactly the same breath, but you're starting to lose the physical sensation, and you're starting to, basically the mental energy and joy is building to the point that it kind of subsumes the physical feeling of the breath. The physical feeling is still there, but the joy in the mind starts to become so strong that the breath starts to look really beautiful, really soft or really bright or even joyful. very stable, and you start perceiving it through more through the mind. So that's the time when it can start to just be experienced as bliss, or it can start to be experienced as a mental nimitta, like light or brightness. And people then think they've lost the breath, but actually you're just experiencing breath through a different sense door. Before that happens, usually the breath, you start to lose the sense of in and out, and you just experience breath, because the things that signify whether it's coming in or going out are the sensations. They're the physicality of the breath. So you just start to experience this kind of generalized sense of breath, and that becomes more and more stable and steady and uniform, if you like. And that's when it starts to become more a mental object. It's almost like perception can start to play with that and come up with different ways to perceive it. Okay. There's a few more minutes. And I've seen one more comment in the chat. The sutta brings to mind a personal situation. Some people close to me are prone to catastrophic thinking. Absolutely. Any advice on how I can help them tone down their thinking? Yeah, good. I mean, obviously this advice is quite deep, because it's asking you to sort of notice how these thoughts arise in the first place, to kind of trace it back to contact, you know, between our mind and the objects, or our eyes and the objects, our nose and the objects. And then to see when, what kind of feeling is arising and how perception arises based on that. And then we build and we go into all this. So one really good way, if you are practicing Vipassana, is that you stay at that level of feeling. And at the level of feeling, you learn not to react to unpleasant feeling with aversion, or to pleasant feeling with craving. And then you don't tend to go through the next stages. But if a person isn't practicing that level of mindfulness, then you could have a look at that sutta, the overcoming of unwanted thoughts. It's actually called the overcoming of thought. It's Majjhima Nikaya number 20, and it gives you five different ways. And one of the first ways is to literally replace the thought, substitute the thought with a different kind of thought. And it's very similar to what they do in cognitive behavioral therapy. I only had this once when I was a teenager for about 3 months, but I definitely was depressed and I definitely had negative thinking. I remember one of the thoughts I put to the counsellor was that I don't want to work on this essay because it might not be any good. And she just said, well, what about thinking, well, my last essay was really good, so maybe this essay will be good. And it was like so simple, you know, just to change that thought. But you've got to first recognize that you're thinking a thought that's not helpful. And then you've got to have enough awareness to actually change the thought into something else. I mean, if you can't work directly with thought, there's also ways to just try and make yourself feel better. Go jogging. That's a good idea. Get out. Do some vagal nerve stuff, calm yourself down, watch something uplifting, listen to a Dhamma talk, that replaces thought. That's why many of you like these sutta classes, because at this time you're just focused on the Dhamma, you're not thinking any other thoughts, or not too many other thoughts that are sort of miserable thoughts, I hope. There's also seeing the danger in those thoughts. I would advise you to have a look in that sutta, because there's quite a few. And I haven't really got time to go through them all in detail. Seeing the danger and also ignoring the thought is another one. And they're kind of sequential. So first you start by replacing. If that doesn't work, you see the danger. You use wisdom. Is this thought getting me anywhere? What is the effect it's having on me? Is it leading to my peace, my enlightenment, my benefit or not? Am I wasting my time? You know, is it exhausting me or is it making me energized? And then ignoring the thought. So if you are meditating and you've just got a lot of unwanted thoughts or negative thoughts, sometimes you can just let them be. Don't fuel them. Just kind of say, right, they're just old karma. They need to burn themselves out. I'm just sitting here anyway. I'm just going to make my mind really open, really relax. Just let them come through. You can like even have images of them coming through like winds in the sky, just coming, going, and just don't give them much importance at all. So they're probably the most important ones in that sutta. The other ones are a bit, one of them's kind of a desperate one where you literally like grit your teeth and kind of stop that thought. And that's good if you're just about to kind of shout at someone or do something really unskillful, but otherwise it's not so helpful in the long run. Certainly not as a day-to-day thing. Yeah, tone down their thinking. Tell them lovely things. If you're in relationship with these people who you see often, you can actually replace their thoughts for them by telling them lovely things, but maybe empathize with them first. Oh, I hear that you may be worried. Tell me more about that. Rather than get engaged with the content, just try and see what's underneath it and then give them the emotional input that they might be needing based on that. And then maybe try to bring up the goodness of their life and the things that have gone well for them and the love that's around them, that kind of thing. It could help. Yeah. Thanks for the question. It's really the mind and the thinking process creates a lot of suffering for us. Yeah, a lot of suffering. Well, there's still questions in the box and I'm usually very reluctant to let them remain. But if you wish, you could copy-paste your own question and bring it back next week. You might have a different question next week. But I'll try and end on time because I also want to share a link to a teaching I'm giving on Monday. You can join by Zoom if you wish. I did ask the co-host to kind of copy-paste it. Is there any chance you could still do that? Or have you done that? And we can pop it in the chat. So this is not to be shared publicly because our Zoom settings need to be protected from any security threats. But for the people here, I thought it's a good way to get this out to you. So I'm going to give a talk called Where Sadness Meets Compassion, which is maybe relevant to the last question, actually, about, you know, empathizing, but then also allowing our emotions that arise to be put to some action, some compassionate action. So we'll see what happens. And also differentiating between sadness and compassion, because the two are different, but there's place for them both. So if you wish to join by Zoom, there are the instructions. You can probably copy paste it, I guess. And while you're doing that, maybe I'll let Minori wind up for the evening. And we'll probably do a part two next week. Yes. Would you like to say something? Can't hear you very well.
Thank you, Venerable. And thank you, everybody. And so a few words on Dana, that is generosity. As you know, when we give, it develops our wholesome qualities that form foundation to improve our Dhamma practice. And here at Anukampa, there are a few ways to improve that quality of generosity. One is a financial way that you can do a donation to Anukampa through our website. There's a link in the chat. And you can do bank transfers, PayPal, and SumUp. And if you're financially able, you can do a standing orders. And other than the finances, you can drop in and do a food donation, Dana, hot food where the Venerables can have for lunch. And for that, you have to check the timetable in the website. Email team at anukampaproject.org and organize a date and they will let you know more details on that. If it is not possible for you to do a Dana afford food, there are different ways like supermarket deliveries and remote deliveries as well. And then there is volunteering available as well, depending on your the tasks that you can do and the times available. So there's a lot of things that we can do as a donor, not only finances. And thank you again, Venerable, and thank you all of you for staying here and being part of this lovely talk. Thank you.
Thanks, Manoi. I have to say, at the moment, we're being so well fed. It's just so touching. It's really touching. We have a freezer full, actually, of food, don't we? And also, there's been a couple of people delivering. There's this kind of company who do food that suits my condition. And someone offered like 3-4 boxes of it, and we've got a full freezer. So yeah, some things we actually don't really need at the moment. We always need supermarket shopping, I guess. Yeah, that's something that on a roster could be really good. But yeah, I just want to express gratitude really for how well we're supported. Because although I know we've got a very international community and it's hard for many of you to get up to the monastery in person, we do receive a lot of sustenance. And part of that sustenance is meeting on these sessions and talking about the Dhamma at quite some depth. So I hope that was interesting and, yeah, not too deep, not too shallow, but just enough food for thought that it doesn't go into proliferation. And hopefully next week. Shall we continue with part 2 next week, or would you just like to read it yourselves? Or, yeah, just right. Excellent. So who would like to do that again and finish it properly next week? Okay, I think that's most. So we'll do that, and we can always elaborate on, you know, side issues like ways to overcome thinking and all that sort of thing. So for me, I think tomorrow there is a metta meditation, 9 a.m. UK time. And then, as I say, there's a talk on Monday that you're welcome to join via Zoom. It goes on for 2 hours, but if you don't have time to stay, that's fine. You can always just vanish. Do the art of disappearing. And then what else? Well, there is a retreat actually on the 24th of January for Oxford Insight. You can also join that by Zoom, and that's on shared values and kindful speech. And well, there's loads of stuff. Today we managed to book a venue for Vaisak. So we're going to have like a day retreat, but a community day as well. So we can talk a bit and eat together and have some discussion together as a community and do some meditation on the 30th of May, if you want to put that one down in your diary. And we might be able to even Zoom Ajahn Brahmin if we're lucky, but I'm not sure because it depends on his timetable. But you'll have me anyway, and Samaneri Upachala, who is right there. You want to wave goodbye? So we will let you go, and thank you so much for your wonderful spiritual friendship. Take care, everybody. Hope to see some of you tomorrow.